This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. 2 years ago, near the beginning of the pandemic, Illinoisans who are following the news saw scenes of chaos at O'Hare Airport. Thousands of people were packed together in the international terminal, rushing to get home before President Trump's travel ban took effect.
Illinois' governor slamming the president on Twitter, calling the lines unacceptable. Chicago's mayor pleading for help.
We need more screeners here at O'Hare, and they need them at other airports across the country.
President Trump responding late today, asking people to, quote, pardon the interruptions and delays, adding, quote, it is very important that we be vigilant and careful.
Unacceptable is not all the governor said on social media. He added, the federal government needs to get its bleep together now. A day later, Vice President Mike Pence had called Pritzker and assured him the federal government was taking the situation seriously. But then, for any Illinoisan in doubt as to how seriously they should be taking the COVID-19 pandemic, the governor made this announcement.
As I've said, there are no easy decisions left to make as we address this unprecedented crisis. Every choice that we face, every choice now, is hard, and it comes with real consequences for our residents. But as your governor, I cannot let the gravity of these choices prevent us from taking the actions that the science and the experts say will keep people safe. With that said, I am ordering all bars and restaurants in the state of Illinois to close to the public as of the close of business Monday night, March 16th through March 30th.
Almost 2.5 years ago, those early optimistic days when the pandemic might well be behind us after 2 weeks. But of course, 2 weeks turned into 2 months, and 2 months has turned into well more than 2 years. And today, some of us find ourselves wavering between relief at the prospect of an ebbing pandemic and anxiety over new variants and the possibility of yet another wave creeping up on the horizon. The pandemic has taken nearly 39,000 Illinoisans, likely an undercount, and left most of us with painful memories, whether from loss of a loved one or the loss of social connection that came with long periods of isolation. It seemed like the pandemic would always be with us. Today, we're listening back to our conversation with a guest who says, with time will come a forgetting of the worst parts of the pandemic. He also says our brains are already doing some of that repair work for us every day. Think of it like a neuroscientist's take on the adage, this too shall pass. Dr. Scott Small is a neuroscientist who studies memory and memory disorders and is the director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Columbia University. Also part of this conversation was Dr. Michelle Cutler, Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. She's also a licensed psychologist with more than 20 years' experience working with children and families with a specialty in working through trauma. Because this conversation is on tape, we originally broadcast it earlier this year, we're not taking calls, but as ever, we love hearing from you. Email talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. And here now is the conversation with Drs. Small and Cutler about forgetting the pandemic. So, Dr. Small, I want to begin with you. You recently wrote an opinion article for the New York Times called We Will Forget Much of the Pandemic. That's a good thing. Through your research, you've found there's a danger in remembering too much and that forgetting is necessary for mental health. Can you talk about that finding and the science behind that?
Yeah, I'll talk about the science behind that. And the important point, I think, to start off with, Brian, is that the new science of forgetting is demonstrating why, much like an engine that has an accelerator and a braking system, our minds, our brains need memory balanced with forgetting. So it's not one versus the other. You need both to live a happy, successful, and fulfilling life. Now, the first thing to say that much will be forgotten, but as I say in my article, much we should never forget. We should never forget the those we've lost, our loved ones. We should never forget and maybe commemorate society for stepping up and doing the right thing. We should never forget what we've learned and rewrite the manuals, whether it's government or medical manuals on how to respond better next time. So that's clear, and that should not be confused by what might be forgotten in a beneficial way. And in this case, the benefit of forgetting is mainly on the emotional realm. We all know that we are exposed to traumas. We all know that you can have a disorder like PTSD, which is effectively the brain not being able to emotionally relax the fears, the fear memories. And that, if that burns too hot, that can cause psychopathologies or distress or disorders. So that's the point about why it's actually a good thing that our minds has this memory forgetting balance.
Well, yeah, and maybe can you just say more then about how memory and forgetting are a balancing act, right? How do we strike that balance?
Well, I'll give Mother Nature all the credit for striking the balance, but I will also point to computer engineers, another form of unnatural engineers, human engineers who've decided they needed to create a memory machine, our computer. And we all know that our own computer needs memory and forgetting. That somehow is intuitive. The interesting thing in writing the book to me as a doctor who focuses on memory disorders and has always really worried more about memory failures is that we've all thought that forgetting, the normal forgetting we have, the one we're born with, we always have, we all consider that a failure of our memory mechanisms. And the new science of forgetting has disputed that simple idea. It turns out our brain has separate mechanisms devoted to memory and separate devoted to forgetting. Again, maybe the engine metaphor works here with both an accelerating system and a braking system.
Dr. Cutler, I want to bring you into the conversation now. Can you talk about this idea that forgetting can help us escape debilitating emotions and how that fits in with your own research on PTSD and intergenerational trauma, for example?
Sure, absolutely. And I'm so glad to hear Dr. Small talk about the balance between memory and forgetting. Because while what we do need to do is be able to move forward and integrate some of these difficult and challenging memories, right? And that's the challenge. So in order to be able to use his language, to forget in a healthy way, we first need to be able to feel heard about what the traumatic experiences were. So for example, even just hearing Governor Pritzker's speech 2 years ago to the day, my body remembered, my body had an emotional and physical response to hearing his speech again. And even though there might be parts about that day that I don't cognitively remember or things about the timeline that I've forgotten, my body holds on to it, right? And our nervous system does hold on to the feelings that we experienced during the trauma. And we're at this unique time where we are at the 2-year anniversary, right? So even though our body, we might not remember everything, our body might be having a response to the memories coming back and may be reacting as if it's happening again at the same time. And all of this happening, this 2-year anniversary reaction, which is very normal, is then happening at the same time as we're getting the push towards things opening up, right? And people might be feeling pressure to return to normal, but normal is not the same as it was before all of this started. So we've got these two conflicting things going on right now, an emotional reaction, perhaps even a physiological reaction to the anniversary of the trauma, but then this sense that we need to move on and move forward, and we have to think about how we can balance both of those and give voice and validation to the experiences that we're feeling because of the trauma we experience.
Dr. Small, I wonder if you were in New York City on 9/11 and whether you can compare, that the feeling of remembering that, right, visiting the memorial, for example, with, how we are thinking about and remembering the pandemic, I guess still in real time as we're living through it, right?
I very much was in New York on 9/11. And in fact, the article you referred to, I first began by comparing and contrasting to that. And, for 9/11 on the balance issue, absolutely, the motto is true, never forget, right? Never forget 9/11. And there's a lot that we shouldn't forget. But what's so interesting to me then is that as we were suffering the trauma, and everyone on the island of Manhattan suffered to various degrees. I lost a brother-in-law, for example, that got that close. The way we helped overcome this, and I'm very interested in hearing Dr. Cutler's view on this, is by socializing. You might remember the makeshift galleries of faces, often nameless faces, that were erected around the site, and everyone streamed down. We had candlelight vigils on the Upper West Side where I live. That's socializing, from my colleagues in psychiatry and psychology teach me, is one of the ways in which we allowed our forgetting, our emotional forgetting, to kick in, the mental health aspect of forgetting. And it's interesting that in this particular trauma, and for many it has been traumatic, the pandemic, the recommendation is to socially isolate. And so there's a real concern, I think, and I've spoken to a number of mental health professionals who are really worried about that sort of double whammy. Obviously, that was the right recommendation for physical health, but at some point, one also has to factor in mental health. And it turns out that socializing is super important. There's even a neurological explanation for that. But like I say in my article, not everything needs a neurological explanation.
Dr. Cutler, do you want to respond to that and talk about that idea of gathering as a way of dealing with grief and bad experiences, and how we were prevented from doing that in the pandemic?
Absolutely. And it was the same thing when this first started. We had those two competing drives, right? We had the drive for survival, which we were being told to stay home and stay away from other people, competing with this other biological drive for connection, right? That we can be starved for connection in the same way we can be starved for hunger. And that's even, there's neurobiological components that parallel that. So one of the things I'm so heartened by now is seeing some, I would say two things. One is the memorials to the people that have been lost during this pandemic, right? This tangible, on a large scale, collective recognition of the grief and the pain that so many of us experienced when we weren't able to necessarily get that while it was happening. During an incident of grief or loss, one of the most helpful things is to be able to feel the support psychologically and tangibly from people bringing over meals and getting hugs from people as we're going through that loss. And during the pandemic, people were forced to deal with the loss of a loved one without having any of that. And which made it so much harder, and then had to, in some ways, acclimate to life without that person, without getting that circle of support. And the thing that I'm so heartened by now is seeing people making intentional efforts to give each other that community and put the rituals into place that maybe they didn't have when the person passed away. So sometimes it's a celebration of life. Sometimes it is going back and doing some of the official rituals. And I think that's so, so important, not just to honor the person that they have lost, but to help the person who's left to remember how many other people cared about that person and share experiences of that person, and then remember how much support that they have. So absolutely, it's very important that we're reaching out and making those connections now, and sometimes even going back and trying to get what we didn't, what we weren't able to get during the height of the pandemic when things were so scary.
Dr. Small, can you talk about how the forgetfulness we're talking about differs from some of the more unhealthy kinds of forgetting that you might see in, say, a patient with Alzheimer's?
Yeah, and thank you for the opportunity, because you made reference to the book. The book's title is The Benefit of Not Remembering. It is categorically not saying that the forgetting, the pathological forgetting that my patients suffer, and they suffer, and I see it. This is not saying that there's a, poeticizing pathology, there's a silver lining, absolutely not. So it's a good opportunity for me to make a very clear distinction between pathological forgetting, and that, as a rule of thumb, is the worsening of your memory over time. Your own baseline memory typically happens as we age, and it could be caused by aging or diseases like Alzheimer's. That's categorically different and what the book is about, which is normal forgetting, the forgetting we're born with. We vary, just like we vary in height. There are some people who have better and worse memory, more or less forgetting, but that's part of the normal brain. And the new insight is, not only do we have mechanisms dedicated to normal forgetting, but we now understand why it's beneficial to have them, that mechanism in balance with memory. So memory and forgetting working together.
I'm struggling to remember, but isn't there a sort of a, if you'd call it a disorder, of people who just have this intense recall of every little aspect of something? Not a photographic memory, but yeah.
Yeah, there's something called the eidetic. There are all kinds of terms. Yeah. To be honest, it's never the kind of thing that many people think. It's never the kind of superhero ability to remember everything. There are people who have outstanding, almost magical type memories for categories, for autobiographical information, for numbers, for music sheets, but no one has that superhero property. And actually, in reading, writing this book, it turned out that if that superhero property existed, it would come with a very dark side. That person would not be able to live in a world that's very fluid and chaotic, would not be able to forgive and forget, would suffer every pain and humiliation in perpetuity, would not be able to be creative. So it's a good thing that that actually doesn't exist, and it's more of a myth than a reality.
Okay, we need to pause and take a break. We're listening back to our conversation about forgetting the pandemic with Dr. Scott Small, a neuroscientist who studies memory and memory disorders and is the director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Columbia University. Also contributing to this conversation was Dr. Michelle Cutler, associate professor of clinical psychology at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. She's also a licensed psychologist with more than 20 years of experience working with children and families with a specialty in working with trauma. We're going to continue listening back to this conversation recorded earlier this year. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just joining us, we're listening back to our conversation about forgetting the pandemic, recorded earlier this year. We spoke with Dr. Scott Small, a neuroscientist who studies memory and memory disorders and is director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Columbia University. We also spoke with Dr. Michelle Cutler, a licensed psychologist and an associate professor of clinical psychology at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. Because we're on tape, we're not taking calls. But as ever, let us know what you thought in real time on Twitter, at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. Okay, let's pick up where we left off. Dr. Cutler, I mentioned you have long experience working with children and families, and your specialty is trauma. Can you talk about how has working with patients changed with a sort of universal traumatic event like COVID-19 happens, and not only happens, but continues to exist in the background?
Sure. A lot, I would say, right? I mean, things change very rapidly for us as therapists from the beginning. And one of the things that we had never really experienced to this level was, as we were going through this collective trauma, we ourselves were dealing with many of the same issues that our clients were. So we had to balance all of that. We still do, to be honest, with being able to be there and sit with and hear and honor our clients' experiences, while at the same time managing our own reactions, because we could certainly relate and we might have been going through the exact same thing earlier in the morning, to be honest, sometimes. And that allowed for a number of different things. First, it was we had to really start to focus even more on taking care of ourselves and connecting with each other. I think the collective experience has really led to a greater understanding of the need for mental health services, particularly with parents being able to notice and understand and then ask for help when they see that their children are struggling, which has been a wonderful thing. Of course, then there's such a high need that we're still working on being able to respond to all of the kids and families that need additional help in dealing with the effects from the pandemic. And I really think, you know, I was thinking back to the beginning of this too about some of the very special moments that we had as we started seeing clients online, because
at the very beginning, that's all we could do, right? And there was this rapid shift to doing virtual therapy rather than having clients in our office. But it really did initially, you know, we were let into clients' lives in a way that we haven't been before, being able to see your young child client's room and having them show you around and meet their stuffed animals and see the place that they've been telling you about for maybe years, really did bring us closer in some ways. And then we had to navigate all of that as we were continuing to help them manage what was going on with them. So it was a very unique time that we've certainly had to adapt to and ebb and flow in and out of as the pandemic has changed.
I want to mention a couple of calls and text messages we've gotten in this conversation. Dory called in, said, "We'd like to remember how unprepared we all were, not helpless, but I never want to forget how unprepared we all were." And then we got a text message from Kathy who said, "Perhaps it's good if we can forget the fear and trauma, or maybe not. We must remember how unprepared we were, and to some extent we still are. Not enough tests, not enough masks, even 2 years in, misinformation, political infighting, a million deaths, untold long COVID cases, unreliable and confusing info from the government and CDC. We still haven't learned. We can't wish it away. Denial does not negate the facts. Heaven help us to deal with the next disaster and the financial repercussions too. The next thing may be climate change or disease or inflation or war with Russia. Have we learned to hope for the best and prepare for the worst? We must not forget." Dr. Small, can you talk about that? This idea of, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, but say more about, you know, what's important for us to remember and not to forget, and maybe our memories work against preparedness for future disasters in some ways by, you know, allowing us to forget some of the worst of things.
Yeah, I completely agree with the with both of those comments you read, which were written very eloquently and to the point. The idea here is just like a person who has a negative experience, let's call it a trauma, that person needs to forget some of the emotional elements, the valence of that event, so that they can function in the future and maybe prevent that trauma from happening again or exposing themselves to that same trauma in a very constructive manner. And in kind, you know, there is something called communal memories and communal forgetting. As a society, we have to absolutely learn how to do better, because we clearly we're not ready. And learning and rewriting textbooks and manuals, that's a form of memory, a communal memory. And I completely agree with that. But by analogy, if we were so buried with fear of what happened and could not really shake that and let go to a certain extent, these are all colloquialisms of forgetting, the ability to think clearly, to the ability to craft better first responders' ways of dealing with a future event, whether it's climate or another epidemic, pandemic, that requires our brains to forget some of the fear valence. So that's the kind of forgetting that we're talking about here. That kind of forgetting is actually beneficial to achieve what both of your listeners were commenting on.
Is there a difference you see in people who feel stress maybe from something ancillary to the actual SARS-CoV-2 virus, right? Like having to work in an essential industry during the pandemic, or, you know, having financial stress, or maybe the way people of Asian descent were targeted for violence?
I'm not sure if you're asking me that, Mike. That might be a question more to Dr. Cutler, because she's the true practitioner. You know, one thing I would say is that, you know, the pandemic of 1918, we actually did not do a good enough job using our personal memories and our communal memories. And there's a lot of articles written about that, and there's a lot of reasons why we didn't. So that's the example of what I think we should be preventing here by tapping into the benefit of the balance between memory and forgetting. If you're asking, Brian, about fear by association, just to be clear, is that what you're asking about? You know, someone might be now more fearful about SARS or something else that might not actually be COVID-19, but still be an infectious-based pandemic.
Or I guess if your main fear of the pandemic, and maybe I will direct this to Dr. Cutler, if your main experience of the pandemic was not so much fear of disease because you were staying at home and you had a family and you could work from home or whatever, yet you were of Asian descent and being, you know, feared being targeted for violence or your relatives being targeted for violence, as we saw during the pandemic, you know, is how does that differentiate and how does remembering and forgetting work with regard to that sort of experience?
And I think, you know, and I'll go back and address your question about each person's individual experience. But when I'm thinking about this balance between forgetting and remembering, really what I'm thinking about is integrating, right? So there are aspects of going through a trauma that we want to be able to hold on to, right? Because we can learn from them. And in order to be able to reduce that emotional valence, we do have to be able to process what happened to us. So we do need the place to have our experience validated and heard and understood and really be able to give it the time and the space that it deserves to then be able to use what we've learned from it and function in the world going forward, right? Because it's when our memories are not processed or not given that space that they're going to come up when we're not ready for them and be overwhelming, right? That's what we call intrusive experiences for PTSD. And healing and integrating from a trauma doesn't mean that we never experience reactions to the trauma, either from the actual trauma or from an anniversary, but it means that when those reactions come up, we're able to recognize them and take care of ourselves to manage them so that they don't overwhelm us, so that all of our cognitive and emotional abilities are still online because they haven't been overwhelmed by the trauma experience. So, and part of what you were asking about is how are people affected differently, right? By maybe their closeness to the trauma or their level of immediate threat or harm or vulnerability. And I think what's important to understand from that point of view is it's really hard. I mean, we can make generalities. Yes, in general, the closer people are to a traumatic experience in terms of the level of immediate threat, of physical threat, that does tend to be more difficult for them. But at the same time, really the response to trauma depends on each person's own idiosyncratic experience and meaning making of it, that it might be just as traumatic for someone who didn't have an immediate loss, but because of what it, for example, brought up for them because of issues of past trauma. And so we really have to be careful of putting these labels on ourselves and saying, well, we shouldn't be having a difficult time because my experience wasn't as bad. And really honor our own experience, because that's what plays a large role in the outcome, is the meaning that we are able to assign to what we went through.
Dr. Small, we're coming to the end of our conversation, just a few minutes left, but can we just talk a little bit more about social isolation, which many of us have experienced to some degree or another during the pandemic, and how that affects memory?
Yeah, so, and again, Dr. Cutler Sheridan might weigh in here, but talking to the PTSD experts at Columbia, where I work, apparently what was learned sadly from Vietnam and other wars is that the worst thing you can do for a combatant who comes back from the battlefield is to have them socially isolated, living in, you know, without a social fabric, with their minds looping with misery and dread. The best thing you can do therapeutically, and as I understand it, it's part of the standard of care, is make sure that these people, and I gather not just combatants, but anyone who's exposed to severe trauma, is not isolated, whether they have professional help or friends and family. And as I said at the get-go, not everything needs to be neurologically reduced or boiled down, but there's some really interesting science here on how just eye-to-eye gazing releases a brain chemical called oxytocin, which does many things. But one of the things it clearly does, and this comes out of the new science of forgetting, is it sort of turns down the hyperactivity in the area of the brain that stores fear memories. And so there's a true mechanism or molecular mechanism for why social interaction, loving, laughter, hugging, as Dr. Cutler mentioned, could really turn down the scream of our fear memories.
Dr. Cutler, just about a minute left if you want to respond to that or offer any other sort of practical farewell thoughts for our listeners as they're thinking through these things.
And I can't help but think to share the importance of the parent-child relationship in this. So yes, right, oxytocin is the biggest hormone that's released, particularly during parent-child bonding, right? And we have seen our children go through so much in the past 2 years that where we just didn't feel like we could solve their problems, right? We didn't feel like we could give them back the things that they had lost. But all of the research, and I see this consistently in my practice, and my students see it with their cases as well, points to the most important factor in helping children mitigate the impacts of being exposed to a trauma is the relationship of a supportive caregiver. Even if we don't have all the answers, just letting our kids know that we are there with them, we are there for them, and we will be looking out for them. And we are here to listen and to try to understand what it's been like for them, makes the largest difference in their recovery from all the challenges that they've been facing in these past 2 years. So there's a lot of power in the parent-child relationship.
Good thought to end on, I think. Dr. Michelle Cutler, Dr. Scott Small, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st.
My pleasure.
Dr. Michelle Cutler is Associate Professor of Clinical Psychology at the Chicago School of Professional Psychology. Dr. Scott Small is Director of the Alzheimer's Disease Research Center at Columbia University and the author, separately, of the book Forgetting: The Benefits of Not Remembering. His op-ed in the New York Times, we'll have a link to it at our website, 21stshow.org. It's called We Will Forget Much of the Pandemic. That's a Good Thing. And that's all the time we have for our show today. Before we go, I want to urge you to visit our website, 21stshow.org. While you're there, you can subscribe to our podcast. We're also on Apple Podcasts and NPR One, Spotify. Just search for The 21st, The21ST. And you can also catch up with some great segments we've had in recent weeks, such as my conversation with an Illinois Wesleyan University professor who discovered a new lizard in Peru. And about halfway into our conversation, he revealed that he and his colleagues had been basically tracked by a narcotics gang. They had to be rescued by special forces. It was a fascinating conversation. You can find that on our website, 21stshow.org. The 21st Show is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.